WMCA presents New World A-Coming. New World A-Coming, dramatizing the stories of men and events affecting the lives of all the citizens of the free world. Tonight's play, written by Saul Carson and starring Norman Rose, is entitled Portrait of a Diplomat.
There is a widespread view that diplomacy is a game where it pays to be shrewd, where moral laws are somehow suspended, and where it is laudable to fool your adversary. Need I tell you that such a view is wrong? Diplomacy of this kind may yield temporary and limited successes, but it will never lay a foundation for lasting agreements or understanding. The highest qualities in politics and diplomacy are the highest qualities also in common life.
Spoken indeed like a diplomat of the present day, which is not where I, nor some of my friends gathered with me here now, belong. For this voice you have heard speaking of diplomacy is the voice of the quick. We are the dead. I, for instance, am...
You might at least, Prince, have the decency of presenting us first.
Oh, yes, of course. 1,000 pardons.
You always were forgetful when it suited your purpose.
Only occasionally. Now then, we who have been diplomats and teachers of diplomats have had through the ages many names, all meaning virtually the same thing. My Indian friend here called himself, in Sanskrit...
Rajadutta.
In Italian, I called myself Ambasciatore Residente. In Chinese, we were called...
Etashin.
Ours, you see, is an ancient profession, very old. In Latin...
Legatus.
Persian...
Saphir.
Greek...
Diplomatus.
That gives you a general idea. Now, that Greek
In
word...
In Russian, you have not called upon me for the Russian.
Your turn will come, madame. We have just heard that the Greeks had a word for it. Repeat, please.
Diplomatus.
Precisely. Taking it from there, Mr. Webster, please.
A diplomat, one employed or skilled in international diplomacy.
Yes, exactly the kind of double talk one might expect from you, Mr. Webster. Now, sir, what is diplomacy?
Diplomacy is the art of, well, or the practice of conducting negotiations between nations as in arranging treaties, including the methods and forms usually employed.
Ah, the methods and forms usually employed. Usually. A time concept. Now, when in time did we start using diplomacy? We have reason to believe that the first diplomatic steps were probably taken by one of my dead friends here.
Wake up, Neanderthal, you're on.
This is Neanderthal man. Homo sapiens, the scholars call him, although why, I know not. Anyway, way back in days before recorded history, Homo sapiens...
Did you call me?
Yes, I did, Mr. Sapiens. Now tell me, you lived in a cave...
Cold, wet, drafty, always wet, drafty.
Yes, I understand. In the cave, you kept your women walled up, is that right?
Women.
What did you do about food?
Food? Hunted?
Mostly at night?
Night. Mm.
And your next cave family... They hunted, too?
Sure.
And sometimes you could not tell your neighbors apart from the other animals and killed your neighbor.
Sure. Kill neighbor.
But your men, too, were killed sometimes.
As long as they don't kill women.
However, you did want your men alive so they could bring home the food.
Yeah. Sent men, talk other family. Let's not kill because food... Only because women.
In other words, you sent two envoys, two plenipotentiaries, ambassadors, so to speak, to negotiate.
Big words. Stone club, better.
I'm sorry, sir. You did send two men to talk to your neighbors, the family in the next cave?
Yes, two men.
And when your envoys, when your men came back?
Didn't.
Didn't come back, your men?
One come back.
And the other?
They ate him.
Gesundheit. There you are. That was undoubtedly our first try. Now, my methods... Oh, I beg your pardon. I never did introduce myself, did I? My name is Machiavelli. Niccolo Machiavelli. 1469-1527. Often a minister of state, never a ruler. Nevertheless, my friends here call me Prince.
One after my heart, too, Niccolo, my prince.
Thank you, Empress. You are eager to get into the act, aren't you?
I wish only to explain
Of that... course, out of turn, but never mind. Now, this lady's formula for a diplomat was really timeless. The formula lasted for a very long time, so we might as well hear from her right now. Your Majesty, please present yourself.
I am the Tsaritsa, Princess of Zerbst, mother of Empress Katerina, Empress of all Russia.
Thank you, Your Majesty. And how do you like your diplomats?
Handsome.
I see.
It is essential that he be tall.
Well, that figures, tall and handsome. Anything else?
A beard. It is preferable that he wear a beard.
Oh, anything else?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Well, do tell us.
His skin. His skin, it must be soft. Smooth and soft.
There were less frivolous formulae. My Greek friend, Professor Demosthenes, lived in a day when a diplomat had to be... Oh, but do tell it yourself, Professor.
An ambassador defending the interests of his state has only opportunities to garner and only words as his weapon. Above all, he must be an orator. He must make a good speech. No, a magnificent speech. Simultaneously, he must perceive every opportunity. He must employ such stratagems, such decent stratagems, as may be open to him. He must...
Thank you, Professor, thank you. He'd go on forever if one would let him. Now, the Roman concept was somewhat different. Here is a Roman general, another type of diplomat. General?
The work of a diplomat is simple and clear. All he need to do is demand an audience in the name of Rome.
I see. And if an audience is refused?
Then we go to war.
Oh, yes. And if an audience is granted?
Then we state our terms for peace, with 48 hours given for acceptance.
But after 48 hours, if your terms are rejected?
Then we go to war.
I myself, Niccolo Machiavelli, wrote my own text on diplomacy. And when I became older, I taught some young men in my methods. Here is one of my prize students.
Then I must study local conditions.
Oh, yes. Assess with accuracy how far it would be prudent to intervene in local politics.
And if I meet opponents, shrewd opponents?
Assassination is often extremely useful.
But is not affability also desirable, Excellency?
Oh, yes. Of the right sort, in the right place. But do not forget, my boy, to have coins handy. Some gold coins at times induce affability.
Yes, Your Excellency.
Mm-hmm. You are married?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good. Leave your wife at home. They're often a hindrance.
Yes, sir.
You have a cook?
No, sir.
We'll get one to take along. We cannot risk your being poisoned. Those files are for your new friends. My student did very well indeed. On his very first mission, he located a document in a boudoir.
Do sit down here, next to me.
Your kindness, madame, is without limit.
But not my time, sir. You came, Excellency, to discuss...
Some important business.
Business with a lady?
Pardon? I mean affairs.
Ah, affairs.
Affairs of great beauty. Do you like these jewels?
They are so beautiful.
As an expert on jewels, would you mind, my good madame, appraising these for me?
Appraising?
If you please. I know that in your dressing room, beyond that closed door, you have a scale for gold and precious stones.
And you would like me to take these jewels behind that door to appraise them?
Yes, madame.
And while I am gone, you will be a good boy?
I shall not take that document which the king had loaned to you. That document on the red velvet table there, I shall not remove it.
Very well, then. I shall go to appraise these jewels.
Thank you, madame.
But you will not copy that document? The quill is on the mantle.
Well, time went on. My methods and the methods of so many of my confrères seemed to become less and less acceptable. New age, new theories, new practices. Something called conference diplomacy began to take shape. There was a war over religious affairs, chiefly, that lasted 30 years. Finally, that war ended. The world saw
the Congress of Westphalia, 1648.
Later, the wars of Napoleon tore apart the world. The Napoleonic Wars were over, and we gathered at
the Congress of Vienna, 1815.
A century passed, and more. World War. World War I. Even that war came to a close. We gathered at
Versailles, 1919.
Right after that, in 1920,
the League of Nations.
The League didn't help. World War II. At last, World War II had stopped. It is a day in San Francisco, April 25th, 1945.
We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold suffering to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small, and to promote social progress and better standards of life and larger freedom, and for these ends to practice toleration and live together.
It is 1953, the seventh session of the United Nations General Assembly. The chamber is jammed to capacity. In the chair, a future Nobel Peace Prize winner, Canada's Minister for External Affairs, Mr. Lester B. Pearson.
Members of the Assembly, I feel sure that on this occasion, I speak for every member of the Assembly in extending our congratulations to our new Secretary General. We welcome him warmly, and we wish him well as he undertakes his new and internationally important duties. But we do more. We pledge him our cooperation and our support.
Now the Secretary General is to make his first pronouncement of the Forum of the World Organization. How does one make this kind of maiden speech? It is not only what is said, but how he says it, which will determine the stature of the man. So, the world listens.
With humility, I accept an election expressing a confidence in me which I have still to justify. With humility, inspired as much by my knowledge of personal limitations
as by my awareness of the extraordinary responsibility which you impose on me by your election.
Well, we old-timers, all the way from Homo sapiens to myself, we are really out now. But the world still wonders, who is this man? Who is Dag Hammarskjöld, the new Secretary General?
Well, as a Swede, I know Dag Hammarskjöld, but perhaps better than I. Why don't you look into what Dag Hammarskjöld's brother, his brother Sten, had written?
Sten Hammarskjöld?
Yes, his eldest brother. Would you like to hear?
Oh, yes, please.
Dag was born, this is what Sten has written. Dag was born to the sound of battering waves of stormy Lake Vättern in Jönköping, southern Sweden, where our father was then president of the local appeal court. All through his youth, Dag lived in an atmosphere of international politics. Our father, Hjalmar Hammarskjöld, was a Swedish arbitrator in the peaceful dissolution of the Sweden-Norway Union in 1905. For years, he was chairman of the old International Court of Justice at The Hague.
Ah, now we seem to be getting somewhere. Will you proceed, please?
Dag, my youngest brother, is the type of man who gets good results quietly and simply, almost without being noticed. He always walked a clean, straight road wherever he wanted to go.
Thank you. Now we see something of what has made Dag Hammarskjöld the impressively intellectual but devastatingly impersonal man that he seems to be. At first, however, those who cover the United Nations, the correspondents of the world's press and radio, they are still not satisfied. Whenever they have the opportunity to do so, and they always have that chance at scheduled press conferences, they probe, question, sometimes even challenge.
Lash, New York Post.
Autorized German press agency.
Rothwell, News Chronicle, London.
The man establishes himself not only with the world press, which is important because it interprets him and his policies to the world, but with the diplomats at the United Nations, the plenipotentiaries of the nation members. He has developed a technique of his own. He calls it quiet diplomacy. He is in office less than 3 years when the General Assembly puts his technique of quiet diplomacy to the test. Dag Hammarskjöld is sent on a mission to Peking. 2 weeks later, on January the 13th, 1955, we listen in on a United Nations transmission.
This is United Nations Radio reporting from New York City International Airport. As Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld arrived here a few moments ago, completing his historic journey from Peking. An air of tense expectancy has marked his arrival as a large crowd of newspaper men, cameramen, reporters, photographers, representatives of a number of delegations of the United Nations and officers of the Secretariat have been gathering here to meet him. Among the delegations, I've observed representatives of the Swedish, the American, the United Kingdom delegations. Here's Mr. Hammarskjöld now.
My visit to Peking was the first stage in my efforts to achieve the release of the 11 flyers and other United Nations command personnel still detained. I feel that my talks with Mr. Chuan Lai were definitely useful for this purpose. We hope to be able to continue our contact. The door that has been opened can be kept open, given restraint on all sides.
Dag Hammarskjöld's quiet diplomacy had opened a door, an open door which led to freedom for American flyers. Now the world has begun to believe that there may be some value to his new formula. His speeches, even when they are rhetorical, are given new meaning now. We hear him at the celebration of the United Nations 10th anniversary in San Francisco, June 20th, 1955.
We have come here to look ahead. We join tomorrow and the day after tomorrow to explore together how in the years ahead we may be able to do better than the years gone by in the search for a more secure peace and a better life for the peoples.
This is a copy.
Geneva, August 8th, 1955. The opening of the great Adams for Peace conferences, one of Dag Hammarskjöld's greatest achievements.
This is a conference of master builders of nuclear science and nuclear engineering from more than 70 nations of the world, assembled here under the auspices of the United Nations
to discuss, exchange, and share their knowledge with the aim of harnessing atomic energy to the purposes of peace and human welfare.
1956 brings a series of new crises to the United Nations. Nasser of Egypt has nationalized the Suez Canal. Tension is increased along the Israel frontiers, where, Israel complains, Nasser's Fedayeen are out to destroy the land and its inhabitants. Israel retaliates by invading the Sinai Desert. Hungarians revolt and are crushed by Russian guns. The Security Council of the United Nations meets day and night. Then the General Assembly, day and night. The Secretary General tries to hold things together. Everybody is critical of him, the big powers especially. In the Secretary General's office, on the 38th floor of that tall shaft of glass and steel that we know as the United Nations Secretariat Building, ideas are kicked around, decisive actions taken. On October 31st, 1956, many members of the Security Council seem displeased with their Secretary General because each believes that he is right. Dag Hammarskjöld makes a brief statement to the 11 members of the Security Council.
The discretion and impartiality thus imposed on the Secretary General by the character of his immediate task may not degenerate into a policy of expediency. He must also be a servant of the principles of the Charter, and its aims must ultimately determine what for him is right and wrong. For that, he must stand. The Secretary General cannot serve on any other assumption than that, within the necessary limits of human frailty and honest differences of opinion, all member nations honor their pledge to observe all articles of the Charter. He should also be able to assume that those organs which are charged with the task of upholding the Charter will be in a position to fulfill their task. The bearing of what I've just said must be obvious to all without any elaboration from my side. Were the members to consider that another view of the duties of the Secretary General than the one here stated would better serve the interests of this organization, it is their obvious right to act accordingly.
Dag Hammarskjöld's term of office has just about 18 months to run. If you don't like what I'm doing, he tells them, fire me. A year later, October 26, 1957. Instead of firing, they re-elected him unanimously for another term of office. For 5 years more, beginning April 10, 1958. Hammarskjöld, the man of quiet diplomacy, is now the strongest world diplomat, the most powerful international servant the world has ever known. And he acts his strength. On that day of October 31st, 1957, in making his acceptance speech to the General Assembly, he repeats his challenge.
Last year, I explained in the Security Council how I feel that I should interpret the responsibilities of the Secretary General. I have little to add here, and nothing to change.
Nothing to change. The challenge stands. So that now, when he speaks of his principles of quiet diplomacy, nations know they must accept them. He states his thesis.
It is my feeling that there is now a broader recognition than before of the value of quiet diplomacy within the framework of the organization as a complement to the conference diplomacy of the public debates. My belief is that a further development in that direction is warranted and would in no way reduce the value of conference diplomacy.
And so this man, born to the sound of battering waves, rides the crest of world diplomacy, sure, confident, still humble, but never shy, as for the second successive term of his high office, with world peace as his personal goal and challenge, he hews sternly to the principles he has expressed in his solemn oath of office.
I, Dag Hammarskjöld, solemnly swear to exercise in all loyalty, discretion, and conscience the functions entrusted to me as Secretary General of the United Nations,
to discharge those functions and regulate my conduct with the interests of the United Nations only in view, and not to seek or accept instructions in regard to the performance of my duties from any government or other authority external to the organization.
This, then, my ancient friends, is a diplomat, mid-20th century. Are you ready to retire back into the pages of history, where you belong?
But he doesn't even have an army.
He has the United Nations Emergency Force, General.
Bunk, not to make war, but to keep the peace.
Precisely. Tempus fugit. So do world mores. Good night, General.
Ah!
Ladies, if you please.
He is too straight for me. Bah!
Yes, Your Imperial Highness. And you, Madame?
What the Emperor said, in spades.
As for me, Signor Machiavelli...
Yes, Dr. Cortilia.
Had he lived in my day, my prince would have... decapitated him.
Yes, I understand, my good doctor. Now, Professor Demosthenes here might at least appreciate the Secretary General's oratory.
Garlands and oil he would have deserved in my day. And not only for the manner... but for the method and the meaning as well.
A very high compliment, sir, indeed. I think then that I might add only that my philosophy, admittedly shady, if suited to the purposes of men I served, like Cesare Borgia, my philosophy has no place here either. And thus, if I may be allowed one more trick of wizardry...
Achoo! You're forgetting Stupid here.
Oh, he is sound asleep. Let him snore... Away then, back to our own niches in history, such as they were. The portrait of today's diplomat has been drawn. We are not worth even a shadow. Ho ho, pick up Homo sapiens, General.
Come on, dope.
Hold on tight, ladies. Here we go! Gesundheit, Dag Hammarskjöld.
You have been listening to New World A-Coming, which tonight presented Portrait of a Diplomat, written by Saul Carson and directed by Howard Phillips. Norman Rose was featured in the role of the narrator. Others in the cast were Maurice Tarpaulin, Mason Adams, Kermit Murdoch, Inga Adams, Anne Petoniak, Gregory Morton, Earl Hammond, and Ralph Bell. Actuality recordings and other material were made available through the facilities of the United Nations Radio. We are grateful to Mr. Sten Hammarskjöld of Stockholm for permitting the use of portions of his biography of his youngest brother, Dag Hammarskjöld. Music was composed and conducted by George Gill. This was a public service feature of WMCA at 570.